and welcome back to the Video Essay Podcast, a show featuring conversations with leading practitioners of videographic criticism. I'm your host, Will DeGravio, and on today's show, I sit down with UK-based critic, programmer, and of course, video essayist, Lee Singer. Now, before we get to my conversation with Lee, I just want to share with all of you that the Video Essay Podcast now has a newsletter. Notes on Videographic Criticism will be a weekly newsletter by me that attempts to curate any news, notes, links, basically any information that a video essayist or a fan of videographic criticism would like to have. When I asked you, the listeners, for feedback on this show, a few of you kindly suggested that I begin each episode with a monologue sharing my thoughts on videographic criticism, an individual essay, what have you. And while I was very flattered by the response, I have found that the podcast format is not one in which I feel very comfortable for anything but conversation. And I think I came to this conclusion after having to edit my own voice for hours and hours before the release of each show, which is an experience I would not wish upon my worst enemy. So this is a happy medium. The success of this newsletter will rely in part on you, our listeners. Please send me stuff. That includes, you know, once festivals and conferences and events are able to happen again. I see this newsletter as being, as I said, a mix of news, random thoughts, links, information on the podcast, some smaller Q&As with creators, and more. Each week, I'll begin with a sort of short commentary, whether it's an essay on something I'm thinking about related to videographic criticism, or perhaps I'll finally finish some of my own videographic work and be able to share it there. And I'm also interested in publishing guest commentary. So if you'd like to contribute a short text about a video essay by someone else, not your own, or a topic related to videographic criticism, this could be teaching video essays, or perhaps you have a particular critical mode or way of engaging with videographic work that you'd like to discuss, I'm happy to publish 200 to 300 word commentaries. And if you're interested in that or interested in sending me any tips or information or questions or anything at all, you can email me at willdegravio@gmail.com or DM me on Twitter or visit our website where there are several different ways to contact me. You can subscribe to the newsletter at thevideoessay.substack.com or find more information at our website, as always, thevideoessay.com. And finally, before we get to our conversation with Lee Singer, I just want to say how moved and thankful and excited I am by the response that we received to the Pecha Kucha homework assignment. More than 30 Pecha Kuchas were made. Many of you made more than one Pecha Kucha, which was just fantastic. And many of you in your emails to me with the link to your Pecha Kucha mentioned that you found the exercise fun, cathartic, therapeutic, a welcome distraction in these troubling times. And it really moved me so much to hear that. And I'm so pleased that this exercise was, you know, able to provide some solace to people as we deal with the coronavirus. You're probably wondering now where you can watch these Pecha Kuchas. If you haven't seen them already on Twitter, I've been trying to retweet and tweet out as many as I can. You can find them at thevideoessay.com/PechaKuchas, or just go to thevideoessay.com and click the community tab where you'll find them all gathered there. And you're also probably wondering what your next homework assignment is. Now, we're going a little bit out of order here of the exercises that are typically assigned at the workshop. Usually the second exercise, according to the Videographic Essay, which again is a book by Jason Mattel, Christian Keithley, and Catherine Grant, that talks about these exercises, how they developed them for the Scholarship in Sound and Image Workshop at Middlebury College. The second essay there is a voiceover. Now, I know that is for many people the most intimidating form of video essay, so I'm gonna save that one for last, or you know, close to last, but it's coming. So get ready. But before I, you know, push you over into the deep end, I figured we would skip to exercise number 3 for now, which is the videographic epigraph. This is an assignment that was inspired by several tribute videos that Catherine Grant has made in the past. And so I quote here from the Videographic Essay, which again is an online open access scalar book by Jason, Chris, and Katie, which you can find at videographicessay.org and that I will link to on thevideoessay.com. But here is your assignment. Select a sequence from your media object. Now, typically at the workshop, we would ask you to work with the same film that you used for your Pecha Kucha, but I will allow you to switch for the purposes of this assignment. But if you can, try and use the same media object, whether it's a TV show or a movie that you selected for the Pecha Kucha. And then select a quotation from a critical text, one that is not specifically related to your media object, of no longer than 5 sentences. Then put the quotation on screen in some dynamic interaction with the video. Typically at the Scholarship in Sound and Image Workshop, participants are asked to manipulate the video in some way using transitions and effects, and also replace or significantly alter the soundtrack. That could be with outside music or music from somewhere else in the film. I'm not going to make you do that. It's optional. It's for extra credit. But right now, let's just focus on the text and the images. And then the one other stipulation is that the completed exercise can be no longer than 3 minutes. So there's your homework, the videographic epigraph. All the information you can find at thevideoessay.com. And I'll just add that even if you didn't make a Pecha Kucha before listening to today's episode, that's all right. If you want to make one, go ahead, email it to me, willdegravio@gmail.com, and I'll add it to the webpage. Or if you didn't make a Pecha Kucha and you want to make a videographic epigraph, still go ahead, feel free. This is all for fun. Do whatever you want. Send me what you make. Let's go make some awesome videos. And now here's our conversation with Lee Singer.
I love the way the people seem to be dissolving into the background. It's like the environments, you know, are stronger than the people.
And now we come to the interview portion of the show where I'm sitting down here with someone who I met on my first weekend in the UK at a video essay event at Birkbeck, hosted by Katie Grant in London. And, you know, when we met, we said, oh, okay, we gotta get together. We gotta record an interview of the podcast. And we planned to meet up and record one in London, but then the coronavirus had other plans. Certainly a very, very minor inconvenience amidst this whole crisis. But either way, I'm super happy to be sitting down here with Lee Singer. Lee, welcome finally to the Video Essay Podcast.
It's great to be on it, Will. I really admire what you've done with the podcast so far. So thank you very much for inviting me on.
Well, thank you. And, you know, as I've this has kind of become my opening introduction, is the finding of my guest's origin story, as I've started calling it. But one of the things that I think is so great about this podcast is that we get to kind of meet the person behind the video essay, which I think is really unique because I think video essays are often so personal. So sometimes we watch one creator's work over and over again, we feel like we know them. And then at least I, you know, sometimes will take a step back and be like, oh, I actually don't know anything about this person. Lee, tell us your kind of origin story, your background, and what got you interested in making videographic work generally.
Sure. So I was working as a film journalist for probably about 10, 12 years before I ever did anything in the video field. So I was a writer. I wrote for various newspapers, magazines, websites here in the UK. I'd also had a slight background sort of filmmaking, and I say that with a very small small F, because it was kind of for my own amusement. It wasn't stuff that went to festivals or was done with any commercial scale, but I'd always been interested, and I had sort of editing software, that kind of thing. I guess I started to see probably 5-6 years ago what would have been some of the early video essay or videographic work. So the likes of Kurganada and Tony Zhao, Matt Zoller-Seitz, Kevin B. Lee. And it just fascinated me because it was like, okay, this is a kind of advance of the thing I do, which is, you know, write and talk about film, but it's doing it in a really interesting and different way. I guess connected to that, many years ago, so I was a kid, teenager, probably early 1990s, there was a show that I just by chance came across on Channel 4 in the UK, and it was called Movie Masterclass. And basically, it was a professional sitting down at like a Steenbeck editing station with a bunch of National Film and TV School students and analyzing a film and sort of stopping it, going through it. I think Roger Ebert did something very famously in his film festival, but I didn't know Ebert at that time. So this was the first time I've ever seen anything like this. And I remember very vividly, there were 2 episodes that I caught. One was with Seven Samurai. And, you know, it was just explaining, you know, the grammar of the film and how Kurosawa layered the sort of the different characters to sort of show their importance, that kind of stuff. And, you know, the editing and the kineticism. And the other one that made a massive impact they just, I think Distant Voices, Still Lives had only recently come out, and I'd either seen it or heard of it, but Terence Davies did an episode on the Ingmar Bergman film Cries and Whispers, and it was amazing. I mean, he, you know, the way he, you know, he saw and identified how the camera was working, the colors, the performance, and he's a very passionate guy. So, you know, he really, it was very emotive, and I'd never seen anything like it. And I was like, wow, because I loved films. I'd always, since I was a kid, I'd always watched stuff. And, you know, in my own way, I was like, you know, doing the thing in the notebook, you know, writing who was in it and all of this kind of stuff, but not criticism. And so that was my sort of first experience with that. Subsequent to that, I went and studied film at Warwick University. I was very lucky to have some of the best sort of academics at the time, you know, teaching that, those courses. So Richard Dyer, Jeanette Fonsandeur, Jose Arroyo, and many, many others. And so it just kind of, you know, sharpened my interest for all of this kind of work. That said, I didn't go into journalism until many years later. I came out of university, did a whole bunch of very random, very interesting, but nothing to do with that. And then about 10 years after that, I got into the writing side of things. But I guess when I saw some of those early examples from the people I mentioned, it was like, well, I've got editing software. You know, I've got a bunch of films because I love films. Maybe that's something I could try. And so I guess that's where my sort of first attempt, you know, stemmed from.
You mentioned the Roger Ebert breakdown, and I think that his quote was, "Each year we find new things in the films. They're not there, but we find them." Which now that I'm thinking of it, that could be, I think, the mantra of the video essay.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly drill down, try and pull up any little nugget. It's like Tom Waits in the Coen Brothers film, you know, like sifting away, you know, any little nugget you can find. I'm not talking to myself yet and calling myself Mr. Pocket yet, but you know, it's close.
And you know, you mentioned some of those early video essayists that you were watching. So there are two main audiences, I imagine, for the show. One, or maybe three. One is people who just love watching video essays. They love doing that. Two is people who make video essays and they're interested in hearing from other people who make them. Three is someone who has not yet made a video essay, but really like wants to, and is just maybe wants to dip their toe in, but just needs that little bit of encouragement or advice or what have you. So what was, talk about the first video essay that you made. What was it? Did, you know, where was it published? And talk a little bit about the process of making your first video essay. I always think that's fascinating.
Sure. So the very first thing I did, so I had the idea, all right, I'm going to do something. And I'd always been kind of fascinated by this whole concept of breaking the fourth wall, you know, the kind of meta movie where people or characters within the film acknowledge that they're in a film. A lot of it's quite fun as well. It's often, you know, quite a staple of comedies, which I'm also a very big fan of. So I just thought, you know, that would be an interesting one to do. So I guess I put together what you call a supercut. I mean, for me, it was just, that's a video essay, but it's obviously one type of video essay. The thing was, I didn't really know what to do with it, because in the UK, at least at the time, I didn't really know any, even though I'm a, you know, a journalist, I know some of the film people here, I didn't really know anyone who was doing that. So what I did is, I reached out to a writer and video essayist. He does a lot more than that. Matt Zoller-Seitz in the US. Didn't know him at all, but I sent him a tweet. And I'd really admired, he did a series on, I mean, he's done a lot of stuff, but he'd done a series on Wes Anderson for the Museum of the Moving Image, I think in New York, that really struck me because it was, you know, analyzing the film and then also the influences and, you know, kind of relating the film to the wider cultural context, which is something I think is really, you know, important in these kind of things. So I basically dropped him a line with the link to the video. I was like, look, I really like your stuff. I've just done this. If you could have a look, I'd be honored. Didn't necessarily expect anything back because, you know, I don't necessarily. And I, you know, a couple of hours later, he got back to me and he was like, oh, this is really good. I like this. I'm going to write a piece to introduce it, put it on. So at the time, Matt used to oversee a section on IndieWire called Press Play, which I guess was one of the first kind of dedicated video sites, video essay sites. So he did that. And I'm under no illusion, it's because it had his kind of, you know, seal of approval that it went out, and within a couple of weeks it had gone crazy and it was getting, you know, posted everywhere. And I got a couple of 100,000 views in the first 2 weeks, which, you know, this was all completely nothing that I'd expected. And I guess because it was a kind of a fun one, you know, people enjoyed watching it. But the thing that really struck me, and I guess this is the key point that made me want to keep doing it, as a writer, you know, I've written for a lot of places, and, you know, if the piece goes online, you get the comments back and stuff. And, you know, some nice and some not so nice. But with this, what was fascinating was, I think somewhere in the piece we'd asked, oh, if you've got any examples of your own, let us know. I got dozens of emails from people saying, oh, what about this clip? Oh, you missed that. Oh, do you know this clip? And basically, it became like this dialogue. And I actually made a sequel to that video about a year later. I put a lot of those clips that people had suggested in, even if I knew some of them from before, before, but you know, the fact is someone had bothered to write in and say it. I credited them all in the credits. I got in touch with the people I could still get in touch with. And it was this dialogue. It wasn't like, you know, somebody, you know, sort of, you know, with critics, a lot of the time it's like, this is the look, they are laying down what the situation is. And what I loved about the sort of video essay thing in this case was this kind of democratic two-way connection. And that was what really got me excited about it, because it was like, I can make something and then it can have a life, not just about being spread and, you know, other people watching it, but people wanting to engage with it. And that was such an inspiring kind of revelation to me that I was like, and also, I mean, the other thing is I really enjoyed putting the video together. So the combination of just the fun of doing it and the kind of seeing the potential response and two-way response made me think, yeah, this is something that I could maybe, you know, keep going with.
I love that story. And it kind of reminds me of past guest on the show, Jacob Swinney, his video First and Final Frames. He kind of just made that supercut and it just kind of took off, and he made several different iterations of the video. And now he has the Twitter account, obviously. And so, yeah, video essays build community in this really organic way that I think is really worth like exploring more. You know, why is it about, what is it about video essays? Is it because they're published on YouTube and Vimeo and those feel like more democratic platforms than a newspaper? Like, what do you think?
I think you're onto something there. I think there's something about that because, you know, obviously there are, you know, official magazines and places that publish things that, you know, something like Sight and Sound has a very highbrow reputation. And so if you publish something on that, it kind of comes with the baggage, if you like, of that publication. But I think once things hit YouTube, because obviously all of these places have their YouTube channel that they then also put it on, something about that, because I guess so many people can upload their own stuff onto there, they kind of feel like it's, I'm spitballing here, but there's a more level playing field idea going on. And therefore, I can talk about your stuff and you can talk about my stuff. And I can suggest something to you and you can suggest something to me, that even if it's made by, let's say, a quote unquote, you know, established critic, it doesn't have that same sort of top down thing that I think, let's say, a review, you know, a first look review coming out of Cannes, obviously people will make up their own minds when they get to see it, but it very much sets the tone for, this is going to be a good film. You need to watch this. Oh, this was a waste of time. You know, skip, next on. And I think something about video essays push back against that. And I'm all for that because, you know, we're all, to a degree, in this thing, creators, but we're all viewers and audiences as well. And I think, you know, keeping those two things in play, I'm very, you know, obviously I've made quite a few video essays now, but I'm still very interested in responses, you know, and I mean, maybe we'll talk later on about the video that of mine that we're going to talk about, because that's a very specific example of listening to feedback, even at this stage, and why I think that's a really important dynamic, rather than like, I've created this, you can all now consume it, enjoy it, but don't talk to me about it. It's like, I want that kind of engagement. You know, and it's not always super flattering, but that's just the internet. And at the end of the day, the work is there, and that's the thing. And it's like, it gives people something that they can engage with, hopefully.
And the supercut's an especially interesting one because it, in a way, builds suspense, because, you know, you say, okay, in this, I'm only going to do breaking the fourth wall. And immediately someone in the audience thinks of their favorite breaking the fourth wall moment. And they're waiting for it, waiting for it, waiting for it, waiting for it, waiting for it. And then you don't put it in. They're like, what the hell? I got to email Lee and be like, you know what? You forgot.
I mean, I can't tell you how many people after that first video were like, why did you not put Eddie Murphy from Trading Places, the bit where someone explains to him what a bacon and sandwich or something is? And I was like, because it didn't fit with the thing. I love Trading Places. I love Eddie Murphy. I just didn't have time. But of course, I made sure I put it in the follow-up video. And I'm sure a lot of people are like, thank God he's finally, you know, seen sense. But yeah, I mean, you're right. There is that element of that. And I think, yeah, but this is the interesting thing. It's great for people to talk about it. But ultimately, you are the person who's putting it together. And maybe you didn't know about it, but maybe you chose not to include it. And I think, you know, obviously people don't know that if they were just watching it, but, you know, it's, and that's why it's good to hear from people, because like I said, I then got introduced to a bunch of great stuff that I didn't know. And that was fantastic. You know, and people, you know, it's an education as well.
Well, I am, coincidentally, my dissertation at Cambridge involves heavily on studying breaking the fourth wall in cinema. So I am looking forward to watching that video essay as soon as we end our conversation here today. So
happy to help, Will.
Super helpful. But I want to take a step back a little bit and talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned that you were a traditional, if we can use that word, film critic. You know, you used a pen and you typed used words, not video. I'm wondering how that influenced your video graphic work, because I think one of the things that people who teach video essays always say is like, you know, you don't want to just put images to an essay right? You want to do something that's different, that could kind of only be done with video. And I'm wondering, is that something you thought about? Is it something you struggled with? Like, what was the, I mean, you still obviously write articles and things like that. So is that, do you just have two different spheres of your mind? Are they more interconnected than I'm making it out to believe? It's kind of, what's the relationship there?
I mean, I guess a lot depends on the approach you take on a specific video. I mean, one of the things I love about video essay or video graphic criticisms or whatever is how flexible it is. You know, you can have voiceover, you can have no voiceover, you can have text on screen, you can have no text on screen, you can have literally a concept that then just shows clips and doesn't need any other explanation, or you can have something that absolutely demands that you have to sort of at some point interject and tell people stuff. I think the big thing that I've found is moving from, text writing to video stuff is, of course, there's a lot of overlaps, but I think anyone who's ever written about film dreads that paragraph or the start of the paragraph where you go, the scene where the shot starts on a wide and goes to the close-up and it's slowly, it's like, you have to, you know, in that sense, language is a poor tool to describe what someone else has done visually, but you need to do it in a written piece. And what I love about video essays are, you can, because it's showing something that you would otherwise have to spend time writing about, when you do talk about it, if you talk about it, you can talk about it in a different way because it's cutting out so much of that, you know, exposition effectively. So I think it has changed a little bit. I don't think it's changed necessarily how I write when I write a written piece, but I think there's a lot more freedom when I come to, because I do, you know, a fair bit of voiceover in some of the videos, I can talk about it differently. You let the images do their job. And I guess I try to, we all have our sort of pet things that we like or like less about video essays. I definitely try not to over talk, you know, talk too much. I feel like, you know, especially if you're, you know, you're talking about, you're dealing with a film that's got amazing dialogue or amazing music and stuff. It's like, unless you're doing something better than that filmmaker's doing, you know, or unless there's a really specific reason, don't, you know, let the film do its work. And then hopefully you can, you know, you're in there as well working with it, but hopefully not at the expense of what's already brilliant about the stuff you're doing. So I think it does have an impact on how you talk about stuff, but it's, everything is a different, you know, there's a case by case thing. And it's like, I love doing videos where it's just the images and the sound, or you add music or something with a little bit of text. But it's also equally interesting to kind of ask questions, like literally as a voice, and, you know, try and provoke some sort of ideas and questions in the viewer's mind as well.
Mm, no, absolutely, that makes sense. And I think I couldn't agree with you more about, you know, if you're dealing with a masterpiece, you kind of got to get out of the way at a certain point. To continue, you know, in this vein, you had invited me before, you know, shit hit the fan. You were going to be teaching a workshop on video essays to the UK Film Critics Circle, and you had generously invited me to come along and see what's going on. And I was super excited about that. And I'm wondering, and you don't have to name names, although you can name names if you want. I was wondering, what has been the response that you've encountered from your colleagues who are traditional film critics to videographic work? Are they excited by it? Are they not interested?
I think there's a lot of curiosity about it. I think there's also, and I'm kind of speaking out of turn because I haven't actually done the course yet. I mean, it got pulled, you know, it was literally the week that we locked down was the week I was supposed to do it. But knowing from people who signed up or people I know in the circle who knew it was coming up, I think there was a lot of interest to sort of see what it was all about. But I think it's also that thing of, like, especially if you've been doing a job in a certain style for a long period, there's a certain, you know, trepidation, or maybe at the extreme end, a resistance to a kind of change to a format or a change to a style. I mean, I actually think, I mean, you know, I don't want to sound evangelical about it, but for me, I really, to me, this is an important thing to, you know, alert people about and or just, you know, share with people, because I think if you're doing, you know, if you think about film as a very technologically reliant medium, writing or dealing or discussing it, you could look at it in the same way. And if there are advances that would help you or maybe, you know, change the way you do your job, and in some cases for the better. I mean, obviously there's so much great writing still about film and always has been. But I think there's also becoming a really strong body of videographic work about film. And it just feels to me like if we're dealing with film, and we're dealing with image and sound, to somehow incorporate that into your practice, if that's your job. I don't want to say it's you have to do this, but I kind of feel that. I kind of feel it's a little bit incumbent on you to see, because we're not talking about going to an edit suite and working with someone, you know, with cutting pieces of film. You're talking about, this is stuff that even if you don't do it, somebody, you could work with an editor, for example, and you could shape a video thing. And at least in the UK, there's been some interesting developments here. So there's a company who've done some stuff for the BBC. It's a series called Inside Cinema. And I know some of the guys who set that up. And it's basically kind of 5-6 minute video essays, effectively. And it's on a different thing, a different subject. I did one of the early ones, and I actually edited the one I did. But I think just to streamline the whole process and to fit in with the tech guidelines for the BBC, now what they really want is somebody, you know, a critic or a writer, to write a script and maybe select clips, but then someone else, you know, there's an editor to do that. For me personally, that would be less interesting, because obviously that's part of the creative thing for me. But I think it's given a lot of critics, and I know a bunch of UK film critics who've voiced and written it, I think that's almost like a great introduction to the video essay world. And maybe then they would think, okay, this is something I'd like to pursue, or maybe even try out the, you know, Final Cut or Premiere, or, you know, what it's Sony Vegas, whatever the software is that you could do. So I think there is actually a slow, but, you know, definite movement towards embracing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I'm actually going to have one of the editors of Inside Cinema on a future podcast episode, I'm hoping. So I'll be interested to talk about that, because that's fascinating to me that you wouldn't edit your own, someone to edit their own piece, because to me, like, that almost to me is like just saying, if you're a written film critic, like, yeah, I'm just gonna say my ideas out loud and someone else will write them. Like, you know, it's interesting. So I'm just curious to see how that works. And you could almost make the argument that it's not a video, or if it's a video essay, but it's so collaborative that there's multiple authors, you know, like you can just pinpoint one author.
Sure. I mean, again, it's not for me to say too much about them, because it's their thing. And I was very happy to do the piece that I did.
Yeah. And they're great. I don't get me wrong. I've watched them. They're fantastic. And yeah, I don't mean to knock them at all. It's an interesting way to do it.
No, I know.
Yeah,
for sure. But I just know for myself, it's absolutely crucial to actually put the thing together, because, you know, it's your work, and you're kind of, you know, editing is a skill. It's different to writing. It's different to, you know, music or whatever, but it's a big part of this. And I think, and I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. I know very basic video editing. I'm scared of Photoshop. As soon as there's Photoshop involved, I get my wife is a photographer to help me out. And I'm absolutely sure for a lot of writers, video editing software feels very intimidating. But I think, and you obviously make very good stuff yourself, so the basics are not too hard to master or to grapple with. And I think that's the only thing I want to kind of show, you know, try and take away some of the fear factor of it. What I do, because I haven't done the critics workshop yet, but I do teach at the National Film and TV School. There were some master students there. Now, obviously younger people are probably much more, you know, connected to technology and software and things, but working with them to see the enthusiasm that they get into this kind of thing, because again, most of their stuff is curation and writing pieces. And there's been some amazing work that's come out of that course. And I don't, you know, it's their work. You know, I obviously am helping them to a degree, but it's absolutely their stuff. And a lot of these people, it's their first ever video essay. And there's some fantastic stuff. And I just think that's what it's almost like, you know, trying to get people to sort of give it a try and see, you know, and it may not be for you, but I think there's a lot of people who have great film knowledge, but they just haven't had the technical sort of introduction. And it's almost like, in the way that there's academia and fan stuff, it's like you want to bring those two together to a degree, so that people who know a lot actually can maybe get to grips with the editing, and people who are brilliant young editors who maybe haven't seen, you know, a huge range of films yet, you know, they don't have the knowledge. So it's almost like trying to, you know, marry those two things. I mean, this is not a solo mission by any means. Lots of people are doing this kind of stuff, but that for me is the real interest. It's like show it, because I just know it totally reinvigorated my sort of engagement with film and, you know, journalism as per se, you know, doing the video stuff. If I was just doing writing, I don't know that I would still have the same enthusiasm as I do now because of the video part of what I do.
Absolutely. And I'll say, just as like someone who is a student and was just recently an undergraduate student, I don't think I was film studies and writing about film, but I don't think I truly understood the fabric and the inner workings of filmmaking until I started, you know, disassembling everything and recreating things. Like, it's such a wonderful tool for just teaching and learning about film. One more question here. You know, talked to Philip Brubaker, Jacob Swinney, a lot of folks who publish at Fandor or who work as freelance video essayists. And I just love to get your take on sort of what the landscape is out there right now for someone who's pitching and making video essays, you know, professionally. Do you see a Fandor-like site in the future? Like, what are your thoughts? What's it like out there?
I mean, I won't lie. It's tough at the moment because, I mean, especially now, and who knows what the after effects of this whole crazy virus scenario will be in terms of just publications and outlets even existing, you know, in 6 months' time. But, you know, take that out of the equation. It's a tough thing because I think there's a whole generation that are just used to consuming and watching things for free. And I get that, but obviously, and it's so obvious that it's like sometimes you can't believe you have to say it, but you do. Somebody makes this stuff, you know, and therefore if they're putting their time into it, you know, they need to have some sort of recompense for that. I think, you know, it's so interesting because at least here in the UK with the virus, you know, before there's a sort of lack of respect to a degree about creatives, and it's like, well, what's everyone doing now? They're stuck at home. They're desperately trying to watch stuff, listen to stuff, read stuff. And it's like, it's all things that have been created by someone and it's often taken a lot of time and needs, you know, it's a career, it's a profession. I mean, you know, I'm under no illusions. I mean, I love a lot of the academic stuff that's out there, but, you know, I work in a commercial field. You know, I am a journalist and a video journalist as well now, and I need to earn money from that. The whole Fandor thing, I know you've covered it in quite a lot of detail with some of the other guys that you've talked about. I mean, you know, to sum it up, it was a bit of a shit show at the end, and it was and the way that people were treated was very bad. I think I was maybe less affected because A, I wasn't doing as much for the site as some of these other people, but that was a deliberate choice because I've sort of been burned, you know, with written publications in the past, so I'm always a little bit sort of balancing things. Also, I think the other thing is I don't make a living solely from video work. So there's the written stuff, but there's also, I'm one of the programming team at the London Film Festival. I do some other film programming too, and, you know, teaching now as well. So I was able to kind of spread things around a bit. And I think if I was brutally honest, to make a living right now as a video essayist would be incredibly difficult. I think there are people who do it, but it's super fragile, let's say. I would hope, to answer your other question, I would really hope, and I am optimistic because I know there's such an appetite for it, that another Fandor type place would sprout up, but it would need a bit of maybe some sort of sponsorship. It would need some kind of, you know, real plan that's part of something else. I mean, you know, there are other places out there that they do something else, but then they're also producing original video work. And I think that might be a way to sort of, you know, safeguard it a little bit in the future. But yeah, there's no question that everyone wants to watch these things, but when it comes to, you know, making to paying for them, it's not easy. And I'm not like trying to make a picture of, you know, very stingy commissioners. I think it's just that everyone is so, they have their hands tied behind their back so often with this kind of stuff. But I think because it's so popular, and when you look at people who have made a huge success with their YouTube channels and things like that, people make money at it. It's possible, but it would be nice if sort of official outlets and things started to kind of help support that, because I think there's so many talented people who can create stuff and there would be an audience for it. You just need to somehow synergize that with a sort of financial model that would be sustainable, I guess. I think, I mean, you know, I am always trying to be positive about this stuff because I think, A, the quality of the general quality of the work is so good, and the appetite to watch them is so strong. To me, those two factors make me maybe more positive than I should be given the actual reality of the situation, but you just hope that it will be. I mean, you know, there are places out there that commission video, but it's a struggle. I mean, I'm in a situation now where I have places that I work for on a regular basis, and also I get, you know, private entities or whatever coming to me and asking me to do a particular project, which is great. I, you know, it's part of a range of things that I do. It wouldn't be the only one, and I think I would still struggle even now if it was the only sort of type of work I did.
Well, let's transition to talking about the video essay that a video essay that you made that was published by a fantastic publication that is, you know, supporting videographic work, and that is Little White Lies. And it's your video essay, The Movies Behind Your Favorite GIFs. As always, if you can, you should pause the podcast right now and go to thevideoessay.com and watch Lee's essay. But, you know, if you can't do that right now, you know, we're not going to spoil anything for you now. So I think you'll still get something out of the conversation. Talk a little bit about the kind of how you came up with the idea for the video essay. How does it take shape? Do they approach you and say, we want to do something on movie GIFs, or do you pitch it to them? Talk a little bit about the creative process.
Okay, so and not just Little White Lies, who are great, but other places I work for, it's generally worked of me pitching an idea. I mean, I think that's how it generally works. So I think one of the things, if you're looking to do this kind of stuff, is try and think what would be a viable or interesting project. I mean, in terms of this particular idea, like anybody, you know, gives us sort of omnipresent now on social media. You know, the fact that there's a little button on Facebook and there's a little button on Twitter that immediately releases and thousands upon thousands of GIFs. And I think like many people, you start to see, you know, you start to use them. You start to see people using them. And I was just interested in this kind of decontextualization of specifically of films, because obviously movies are just one actually quite tiny subset of GIFable material out there. But obviously, because it's the thing that I'm passionate about, I was really interested in what does it mean when we just take this fragment of a scene, it's not even a scene, it's a fragment of a scene usually, and we're sharing it and it's being spun around, and do people even know where it comes from? What does that mean then in connection with the audience in the film? Does it matter? So I just had a bunch of these kind of questions, and I think I've made a range of different type of video. By far my favorite type is where it's basically a discovery process for me at the same time. I mean, to some extent every video is, because there's no way you go in with every single thing knowing what you want to say. But with this, there's actually a very large research element to it, because I certainly wasn't an expert on GIFs and where they came from, what it was all about, that kind of stuff. So it was very much a kind of like, well, I'd like to, you know, sort of dive into this and figure out something about it. And a lot of the things that are in the video are discoveries that I made along the way. Some of them completely fortuitous. Some of them you kind of hope you'll get to somewhere in that ballpark. But so I pitched the idea. And again, going back to what I said early on about this kind of connection with an audience and thing, what we agreed early on with Little White Lies is that they would do a Twitter thread asking people to, you know, reply with their favorite movie GIFs, knowing that I would then incorporate that into the video. And again, to me, that's very, you know, just goes with the sort of thing that I'm really interested in, this kind of two-way dialogue or discussion with people who might watch the video as well. And I mean, if you've seen the video, there are a few specific tweets from people that I've kind of highlighted. And in each case, I asked them, you know, I got in touch with them and said, look, I'd love to use this. Do you mind? And they were very kind and said yes. But again, it's like I'm using stuff that they have created independently of me or independently of this project. But it then can sort of all hopefully fold in together and be part of a cohesive whole.
I love that. So there were some of your findings in the video essay that I had never thought of before. Like, I knew that the Robert Redford GIF, that people had confused him for Zach, you know, they thought he was Zach Galifianakis. Like, I knew about that, but I had no idea about the Jack Nicholson GIF. Okay. Like, I also, I mean, which is crazy because The Departed is one of my favorite movies. I've probably seen it 10 times, 15 times. And I thought that GIF was from The Departed whenever I saw it. And in which is like embarrassing to like admit, because when you put it side by side, it doesn't even look like that in The Departed. Like,
it's a few years. I mean, I totally understand people making that connection.
Was that a well-known thing? And then you also, you know, spoiler, you also reveal that it's from Anger Management, and it's not even in the film Anger Management. It's from the trailer. I mean, it's the same scene more or less, but it's a different take they use in each. So the GIF is actually sourced only from the trailer. Like, did you find that, or is that something that people already knew about?
That would, well, I mean, if other people knew about it, great. That for me was, again, a discovery. So I did know that the GIF was from Anger Management. I then needed to get hold of that film, and I was spooling through it, you know, on the DVD player, got to the scene, and I looked at it and I was like, something looks wrong. And then, of course, when I compared it to the GIF, it was not, his facial expressions are different. So then I was thinking about, and I think the DVD I had the trailer on it. And so I literally discovered it as I was putting it together. And I thought, well, that's fascinating, because not only may people not know the film, even if you know the film, it's not even in the film. And again, it was a happy accident in a way. But I think this is for me, the part of the joy of doing these kind of things. You discover, you know, you make discoveries that you had no clue were even, you know, out there to be discovered. So yeah, that was not something I knew about. And again, even with the Redford stuff, I mean, I if I'm brutally honest, I knew it was from Jeremiah Johnson, and I'd probably seen it many years ago and I didn't remember it very well, but I went and watched it afterwards. And very interesting to me is, even if people know it, have they seen it? And does it matter? And actually, I think with GIFs, there's a strong argument to say it has zero relevance. But that to me is fascinating in itself, you know, relationship with movies.
I love that. And I had a similar, my first video essay was called How to Shoot a Film in One Room, which is available on Vimeo if people want to watch it. There's a lot of things I would change about it now. But, and yeah, one of the films I look at is The Hateful Eight. And I just, in going in the editing sweet. I found that at the beginning of that film, Bruce Dern actually breaks the fourth wall and he looks right at the camera. That's before you know that he's kind of being held hostage. And it's almost like it was a way of saying like, hey, like, look out for what's about to happen now, you know? And I'd never seen that until you get in Premiere or wherever and start playing around. So it's, again, part of that creative process. But you said something about, you know, whether knowing whether that's the film or doesn't matter, because when you look at a GIF, sometimes you really only see the star, because as you talk about in the video essay, everything's kind of decontextualized. And you mentioned you had Richard Dyer as a professor at Warwick, who is obviously the star studies person, very influential to me, as I'm sure he is for you and many people out there. How does stardom fit into all of this? Because that's kind of central to the thesis, if there's a thesis, but kind of central to what you're exploring in the video essay. And that is, what is it about stars in particular that make them so, you know, tangible to people making GIFs, but also just videographic criticism more generally? I think we're drawn to want to play around with stars in that way.
Well, in terms of GIFs, I think because they're generally the most physically recognizable element of a film. I mean, you could argue that something like, you know, Michael Bay explosions or, you know, Bellatar slow takes or whatever. But stars are, you know, and have always been this kind of identifier. So to me, it's no surprise that, you know, most GIFs, certainly from films, it's all about the star. In terms of what's interesting to explore about them, I mean, I guess for me, the answer would be it's not more interesting than other things, because I find films so fascinating across so many ranges. But certainly one of the things that is interesting is star personas, performance, you know, taking someone like, and these are very obvious examples, someone like Daniel Day-Lewis, who's an absolute chameleon, someone like Clint Eastwood, who, or Cary Grant, who are amazing stars, but you wouldn't necessarily, you know, sometimes, certainly from an older film, it could be from any number of films. Whereas Daniel Day-Lewis, it's absolutely clear which film, if you put an image of him up on the screen, it's from. So I think they just have this fascinating, I'm certainly not the expert to talk about this, but stars in general, it's this amazing dichotomy of the identifiable factor, especially when they go through an experience on film that we connect to, and then this sort of untouchable thing of like these, you know, gods up there on the huge screen. Obviously, that's so different today compared to the past, when you didn't have all the gossip and stuff about them and you just saw them on the screen, and it was this really, and it was black and white, and it was, you know, like they were larger than life in every respect. Obviously, nowadays, you know, if you see, I don't know, Mark Ruffalo talking about pollution on social media, it's not this, and he, which is great, by the way, it's not, you know, that's part of him now, right? Cary Grant, I wouldn't have known anything other than him apart from, wow, he's super smart, super suave, beautiful to look at, brilliant comic timing. It's only later when you read about he did all these LSD experiments in the 50s and 60s. Like, wow, I would have loved to know more about that. But it becomes part of the whole kind of mythology of that persona. And that to me is very interesting. I think going back to the GIFs, it's just because GIFs are shorthand, basically. And so a star is a shorthand thing, which is why some of the examples I use in there, like the Denzel Washington one, where, you know, this one that's used all the time to the point of it becoming a meme in itself of him sort of, you know, patting his chest in relief. It's crazy to me that that's used, because it's from a really dark, sinister, supernatural serial killer thriller. And I think most people who know, I mean, again, whether that's irrelevant or not, you can argue, but it's like, I think if people did know that, they might try and find a different shot of Denzel, that, you know, because there's always this element of like, if you know where something's from and you put it there, someone else that you send it, especially if you target it by sending it to a specific person, if you have the same frames of reference, there's an additional meaning to that. If I, you know, I love, this is Spinal Tap. If I put a Spinal Tap gift to a friend of mine who I know loves that film as well, there's additional meanings there that if I sent it to someone in my family, literally don't exist. So, you know, there's this, again, interesting dynamic and relationship between the person who's sending the gift, the person who's receiving, and then obviously, which, you know, also I look at in the video, if you create your own one, because that is, you know, it's so easy to just take something that's already existing. But it's actually, as, and I'd never made a gift till I did this video, it's actually quite simple to do. Again, I was thinking, oh, you know, I don't know how to do that, but actually it's unbelievably easy. And it's kind of like, you know, there are some people making some great, you know, homemade gifts, if you like, out there from great movies. And to me, that's very interesting why they're choosing that actor or that film or that genre to play with.
It is interesting because the gifts are also, they're sort of just isolated studies in movement as well. And it makes sense that someone like Cary Grant, who I think moves on screen better than anyone, is he's a very gif-able figure, whether it's like the one you use in the essay of him where they're pouring the alcohol and he's on the couch in North by Northwest, or is it Now I'm second guessing myself. This is the weird thing. It's His Girl Friday where he's doing the Get Out and he's like flicking his arm. Is that, yeah, like that's a very common one that I see. But then you also have, there are sort of figures who have been reemerged because of GIFs. Like, I feel like Peter Falk in Columbo has become like a GIFable, he's become like a GIFable figure now in a really interesting way. And even, you know, Robert Redford, of course, big actor of his time, like the actor, but I'd say, at least to people my age, like, I don't know if he's endured like other actors. So it's interesting that he became one of the most prominent GIFs. Maybe people just will disagree with me on that, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I bet you that, I haven't got the figures and didn't do the research, but I would imagine if you did, you know, the top 10 box office hits of Robert Redford's career, I doubt Jeremiah Johnson will be in there. You know, it'll be Butch Cassidy and The Sting and, I don't know, 3 Days of the Condor and The Way We Were and all of these, you know, big films. That film, you know, as far as I know, it was a well-respected film. It was from a well-respected director, but it wasn't a hit. So it's so funny. I mean, what was fascinating to me, and I didn't go into this sadly in the video, is how did that become even a GIF? Because it's basically a guy with a beard nodding. And the very fact that half the people didn't even know who it was, it's like, it's not because it's Robert Redford nodding that people latched onto it. I mean, it's almost, it's a kind of inexplicable GIF. You know, the Denzel one, he's still a very big modern star. And I would understand, even if the film is a bit of a strange choice and certainly not one of his, you know, I guess, career highlights, he himself is still very much out there. The Redford Jeremiah Johnson one is bizarre to me. I don't get that at all. But, you know, I did some of the, it's not in the final video, but I did a piece. It was one of the top 25 or 20 GIFs from whatever year it first came out, which I think was either 2017 or 18 or something. So, you know, it somehow struck a chord, and that in itself would be worth almost following up. Like, why? There's so many, you know, because he's not even doing a particularly sophisticated or striking gesture. I suppose it's the zoom in. The zoom in is probably what people respond to, because it's a really, you know, it's obviously very timed. The camera zooms in, stops, and then he nods. But even that, I mean, surely there must be dozens of shows that, you know, or films that have a similar gesture.
Yeah, and it seems like the maybe the most one of the most used types of GIFs is like the approval one. You just want to show approval, but you almost don't want to be like too enthusiastic in your approval. Like, you want to have this like detached sense of irony, and that kind of has that, you know, like the Great Gatsby one with the cup.
Yeah,
like
cheers.
Yeah, like people use that one when they use it. It's kind of, it's like approval, but it's almost ironic, sarcastic approval. Like, wow, great job.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, Redford's understatedness obviously has served him well in the long term, because it is quite dialed down. And maybe that's what people like about it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, super fascinating. Well, maybe Criterion will release Jeremiah Johnson, and they can have you do a supplementary video essay on the history of the Robert Redford GIF. I think that actually be, if anyone from Criterion is listening, I think we should get Lee on that.
Out of you said it, so you know, I'm just going to nod silently in agreement. I'm going to do, hang on, zoom in on me. I'm nodding. Yeah. I'm nodding.
Yeah. Well, let's transition to talking a little bit about the video essay that you selected for us to talk about. And I was super happy that you selected it, because this is, I think, the 14th episode of the show, which feels crazy to me. And no one yet, we have not really talked about Koganada yet, which is good in some ways, because it means maybe we're highlighting the work of, you know, lesser known video essayists. But also, you know, if there was a, you know, Mount Rushmore of video essayists, he would, you know, definitely be in the running to be, you know, one of those four faces. So very happy you selected it. And it's Linklater on Cinema and Time. And I'm wondering if you could kind of just give us an introduction to the essay, and then tell us a little bit about why you selected it for us to talk about. What's so compelling or interesting about it to you?
Absolutely. So the video sort of, I guess, structure or style, it's actually an interview that Koganada did, recorded on the phone, I think, with Richard Linklater, talking about, I guess, one of the elements that is a very present and prevalent sort of aspect of his film, which is time. The very obvious example is the Before trilogy, because they're shot, you know, the three films that exist so far are 9 years apart, and you return to the same two characters. And, you know, you're not just watching the characters of Jesse and Celine age, you're watching Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy age. And there's something very poignant about that for me. And obviously Linklater is not the first person to do that. You know, Francois Truffaut with the Antoine Doinel films, Rocky, I mean, Sylvester Stallone, you know, it's like this thing of coming back to a character over a time period, I personally find absolutely fascinating and also very, very moving. So the structure is him talking about that, but then he uses the interview as a springboard to just do a beautifully constructed, almost freestyle montage of scenes from Linklater's films and also films about time, or films that have that element under discussion, or people watching movies over time. You know, everything from, you know, Purple Rose of Cairo to Ozu to, oh gosh, I can't remember who else is in there, Truffaut, Godard, all kinds of stuff in there. And he makes it, it's obviously the focus is Linklater and his films, but he broadens it out so beautifully to look at film in general, because it is the building block of all cinema. You know, a film happens, it starts at this point, it ends at that point. And then what is the most beautiful thing about it for me is how we then, if we like a film, we return to it at different points in our life, and maybe the meaning changes for us. Maybe it's a comfort thing, especially in a difficult time. This relationship of us and the work of art over time is also in this video. So I think it's really a stunning piece of work. I mean, I'm so jealous. I wish I had made, I mean, I love the before films as well. So I would have loved to make a video on this, and I feel like that no one should really do another one on it now, because it's not going to be anything like this. But it's because I admire it so much. I think the thing that I'm really interested in, and I've tried myself a few times to do this, I think it's fascinating to bring the filmmaker into the piece, because, you know, it's one thing for an academic, a critic or whatever, to kind of, you know, tell you what the film means and why this and why that, and, you know, analyze this and look at this camera angle. And that's all fine, because that's part of our job. But to actually have the person themselves discuss it, and Linklater does it in a very, you know, non-didactical way. He's asking questions, which is what his films do. But to have his voice in there is just, for me, an added thing. I feel like he's part of the conversation. I'm listening to him at the same time as Kurganard is doing his work. So basically, what I love about it is the film is a work of art, or the film is something, and then you're using that as the springboard to make another work of art or a piece of filmmaking that incorporates it, but then springboards off of that with the original creator involved. And I think that's one area of video essays that is criminally underdone. And, you know, so I've, through Sight and Sound, because again, a lot of that is to do with access. You know, you're not, you know, so as you say, this essay was for Sight and Sound, and they have probably the clout to get Richard Linklater on the phone. And certainly not every critic or academic has that potential. But I think that is something that we should be doing more of, because I would like to hear it's like director's commentary, but then it's more than that, because you're then creating a new work that incorporates that into it. And I've done a few myself where I've been fortunate to interview a filmmaker and then try and make something using their words off the back of it. I did one very recently, again for Sight and Sound, with Celine Sciamma, and it was that idea. It's like, she's going to talk about Portrait of a Lady on Fire so much better than I would talk about it. As much as I love it and I could talk for ages about it, this is the woman who wrote and directed it. I'd much rather hear her take on what she's doing. And not the video was about not just that film, but her body of work. But then again, I also get to kind of, you know, flex my creativity in addition to that. So it's, I mean, I may be making slightly bigger claim for the video essayist in this overall, but it's a weird and certainly not equal collaboration. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm then using the filmmaker and their work, and I'm trying to make something that expresses what I feel about it, but they're very much part of that. And so that is one of the reasons that this means so much to me, because brilliant filmmaker, brilliant films, and a brilliant expression of Kurganard's own creativity in grappling with what is going on within those films themselves.
Totally. I think that's brilliantly put. And I think I totally agree with you, and I never really seen a video essay like this. And I like getting the directors involved, because there's a certain different element of creating a video essay about a director who's alive. I don't know what exactly that is, but I think it has to do with the fact that they could watch it. Cady Grant, on my first episode, you know, we talked about her, The Haunting of the Headless Woman, and she said, yeah, I think, you know, Lucrecia Martel, I think she's watched it, but, you know, I didn't want to talk to her about it before the creating of it, because I just wanted it to be its own thing. And she said, you know, and also I didn't want her to, I wanted to offer my own interpretation. But when you get the director, and that's one approach, and totally, you know, respect that, and it more fits with the tone of Katie's piece. But, you know, when the director's alive and you get them involved, it's almost a check on you, the video essayist, in a way. You know, not that you can't disagree with the director, that the director's take on their work is the final thing. I don't mean that by any sense. But getting them involved, there's sort of a different rigor to the work. Yeah, you're nodding. Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's definitely it shouldn't be like, you know, the norm for video essays. It's absolutely, because it changes the dynamic and the relationship for sure. And, you know, you should be able to make your own pieces without. I guess it's just a facet of video essay work that I would be interested in, because what I'm absolutely not talking about or advocating for is almost like a director's commentary and you just illustrate it. The thing that I think is so good about this is this is so beautifully and creatively edited. And, you know, he's drawing from other films way outside Linklater's own, but even the way he uses Linklater's own films, it creates something new. I mean, I don't know what Richard Linklater thought of this or if he ever saw it even, but I would, if I was him, I would be absolutely flattered that someone made something so great from what I've done. So it doesn't apply in lots of cases. And of course, you're absolutely right. You should make things just your take on a filmmaker or a film. But I'm just saying this, I wish I saw more of this type of video out there alongside all the other, you know, great pieces of work that you see with analysis, really good analysis on people's things. It just changes the relationship a little bit. And I think it's, you know, it has its place. It wouldn't be for every filmmaker and every essay, but I think it's got, it makes this piece stronger. That's all I would say.
No, and I completely agree with you and understand what you're saying. And this piece almost has the, it's so rich and that I feel like I need to go back and watch it several more times. And I think if you, you know, when you go watch it, listeners, you will feel the same way. But it almost has this sense that Koganada has this video essay and he's making it and he almost just calls up Richard Linklater just to get his thoughts. It doesn't feel like he's compromising anything or working around him at all. And it's just one element. And the fact that the Richard Linklater's audio is so poor, I think makes it even better and more poetic and personal, because as you say, it sounds like a phone call. It doesn't feel manufactured. There's something about it where I was just like, oh, this is like awesome. Like you can almost kind of barely hear him at some points, but it's like you're kind of like leaning in. I was kind of like, maybe it was just my audio was low, I don't know, but I was kind of leaning in like, what is it? Just made it so much more immersive.
Yeah, and there's a bit at the beginning where they say, oh, they're, you know, he says to him, you don't mind if I'm recording this? And he says, no. And then it even says, call recording, like an automated voice. I would be very interested to know if that was real or if he added that for an extra effect of the call being recorded to kind of highlight this sort of very low tech, you know, connection that they're making while you get all these amazing images. I think the other thing for me that's really fascinating is obviously Koganada has gone on to make features now, and Columbus, which was his first film, was I was really impressed with, and I think there's another one imminent. And this to me is again another interesting idea of, you know, how much is a video essay making is filmmaking. And I believe there's a big part of it, you know. I mean, I, some of the people I know who make this stuff, you know, the choice of the music or the font for a text, and then obviously the editing and stuff. We are doing it is a type of filmmaking. I'm not going to say we're, you know, Kubrick and Fincher and all of these guys, but you are creating a new piece. I think the big difference is obviously most people aren't shooting new material. You're using beautifully made images from other people. But the way you know, connect them, cut them, link them, all of that stuff, split screen, whatever. I think there's a real filmmaking angle going on here. And then it's fascinating to me that he's now gone on to become a filmmaker. And I think, you know, in the past, there was always critics who became directors, right? Or screenwriters. And there's quite a long history of that. But I think this might be an interesting development with the video side of things. It's like, with the video essay side of things. It's like, you know, maybe making a feature length thing or a documentary or an essay film, or even, as Koganada's done, going to sort of narrative features, because there's a lot of overlap of skills. And if you're able to edit and construct something and, you know, score it so well as this video does, and obviously he's done many that are also very, very good, I think there's an element there that, you know, that might be a thing that, you know, is worth pursuing. And certainly for me, it's like, oh, you know, the more I do of this, it's something for me to consider of like, is that an area to maybe try to push towards in the future? And, you know, I understand that, you know, again, don't get me wrong, you know, it's not the same as making, you know, writing something from scratch and directing it and being on set and, you know, all of the stuff that video essays are not doing. But I don't think we should also downplay the element of, you know, editing is the filmmaking skill, right, ultimately. And that's the main thing that any video essayist generally is doing. Even if it's just slow motioning the same scene and looping it or whatever, it's still editing in the sort of widest sense. And I think, you know, we shouldn't be shy about talking about that, because if someone says, oh, I liked your video essay, I thought that was really good, they're responding to the construction of an audiovisual piece that you've made. And that's a good thing.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, they're short films in and of themselves. And, you know, but you're absolutely right that, but they're not even trying to be feature films, right? Like they are their own entity. And when Koganada continues to make films or whatever, and someone looks at his body of work, you know, a piece like this, I think will be, you know, in 20, 30 years from now, if someone, you know, writes a book about his films, you know, these, I don't know how you could write about him and not also go and look back at these other pieces, because they say a lot about him as a filmmaker. And
absolutely. You know, the personal style, and you know, if you've seen Columbus, I think you would get a lot from his approach and how you wouldn't be surprised to know that that person made that feature if you'd seen these video essays. I mean, this and the other famous one he did, What is Neorealism? I mean, to me, that's the sort of right up there at the peak of anyone doing this ever, because it's
well, yeah. I was going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say those two video essays, going back to, you know, first things I saw, early things I saw, it's like, wow, if I could, you know, my dream is to make something even in the same ballpark as effective and you know, insightful and beautifully made as those videos, because they're really, really special.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because it seems to me that this video, which I had not seen before you told me that you wanted to talk about it, What is Neorealism, which is kind of in the course I took on videographic criticism, that was the first thing we watched, because it's very clear, it has so many clearly of the elements of what a video essay is, but it's completely different from this piece in tone and style. And then you also have his more supercut video essays, which are, you know, Hitchcock's Eyes and the Breaking Bad point of view shots and things like that. All are very dissimilar. What is it that runs through all those video essays in your mind? Like, what makes Koganata so great? You know, why, like, I know it's like a big question, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but like, you know what I mean? Like, they're so dissimilar. Is it that he can just tackle a wide range, or is there something that runs through all of them? Like, it's such a diverse body of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite hard to sort of identify. I think I would say there's a kind of quiet integrity and intelligence across those various styles. I mean, I'm a big fan of filmmakers as well, who can just turn their hand to lots of different genres. I mean, I love Hitchcock, but Hitchcock made the same type of film, Ad Infinitum, and they're brilliant. They're the best of those films, and they're some of the best films ever made. But I also have a huge respect for people who did a musical, and then a comedy, and then a film noir, and this kind of stuff. So I think with him, because as you say, this is very different to neorealism, there's just that sense of, I don't know, there's a kind of quiet, respect towards the filmmaker, and yet absolutely boldly putting your own stamp or your own style on top of that. And I think what's great about both those two, neorealism and this, you absolutely get the voice of the filmmaker in there. And on top of that, you get the person, in this case, Koganata, who's made the video essay. And that's what I was saying to you about this sort of collaborative idea. It's like, you are not trying to just be subservient to the director and just, you know, they say something and you just illustrate that. You're also not trying to sort of squash them and like, you know, I've got some audio from you, but actually this is what I think. It's this weird balance. And you know, with the few that I've done in a similar vein, that's a really fascinating area to try and negotiate, because it's different with each person. Your feelings for the films are different, but it's trying to sort of work with them after the fact in a weird way, which is it's quite trippy if you think about it. But I think that's a challenge. And I think, you know, something like this does it absolutely superbly. But I'd be interested to see more video essayists tackle that thing, because if it's just you, your commentary, your take on something, there's a layer. I'm not saying the layer's missing, but it's doing one thing. Whereas when you're actually grappling with what someone else is talking about and how they are describing themes or ideas or styles of their own work, how do you sort of respect that and at the same time add something to the conversation? So, you know, and like I say, this isn't relevant for every essay at all, but if you're going to do something that involves a director, to me, this is how you do it. You know, you respect their art, but you also add your own artistic slant on top of it as well, or with it, but alongside it, effectively.
Well, I think that is brilliant advice for us to end our conversation on. Lee, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show and for chatting with me today. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much again to Lee Singer for agreeing to come on the podcast and chat video essays with us. Lee, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. My next guest will be Shannon Strucci. You can find out your homework, what videos to watch, always at the video essay VideoEssayPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter and also follow us on Twitter at Video Essay Pod, on Facebook, The Video Essay Podcast, and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud. Thank you so much. Stay well and safe and healthy. Peace out.